Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. I first met Mike Adams when I went to work for Salomon in 1978. My territory then was Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico. I met Mike in Utah when we were both working for binding companies, Salomon for me and Gatesay for Mike. I knew Mike was a mensch when at a Wolf's midnight sale, I kid you not, ladies and gentlemen, he helped me toss Salomon 222s into a ravenous crowd when the bindings went on sale for $19.99. Also fact, ladies and gentlemen, that's why the crowd was rather frenzied. And at the time, by the way, Wolf's was not an obscure store. It was one of the major chains along with Sunset Sports that sort of ruled the Utah territory. Now, if we look forward a few years, Mike shifts over to Salomon, and he's orchestrating the introduction of one of Salomon's most successful skis ever, the X-Scream. The intro's at Mount Hood, and Mike and I took off and climbed the summit together, which is not exactly like summiting Everest, but it's not as a walk in the park. And we get to the top, and there was some Canadians already there. I think it was Rob Boy, maybe a Delorier or two. Do you remember who we met at the summit, Mike?
Well, it was those two, but I think Dean Cummings might have been around, and there were a few others.
It was a great moment.
Yeah, it was amazing. And in hindsight, perhaps not the smartest idea to boot pack up Mount Hood, which I became, as when I moved to Oregon, I became very familiar with and it's all its perils. But somehow we thought it was a good idea at the time.
Well, we're here to talk about it. I have many other memories of Mike as he rose from territory sales rep to the top of one of our industry's most powerful players. Before we take a deep and edifying dive into the distant past, permit me to first extend a very warm welcome to this week's guest, Mike Adams. Welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Thanks, Jackson. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I've always enjoyed the fact that we've had a long history together. And so I appreciate this opportunity.
Me too. Mike, before we go back to our origins, let's take a snapshot of the present day. You're working on mountain at Park City, aren't you?
I am. I have become part of the Park City community, working at Park City Mountain Resort in the Vail Resort operation. I'm working as a guest services attendant. Responsibilities include things like guest service and directions, optimizing lifts, occasionally touring the mountain as a guide. All this on the canyon side of Park City, which is about 5 minutes from my house. And something that actually I joke about a bit, but it's really been fun because I'm meeting a ton of people in the Park City community, and I'm really getting an inside look into the resort and specifically Park City / Vail, which I knew from a vendor standpoint intimately, but having this look as a seasonal employee is very, very interesting, and I enjoy it a lot.
You have a snappy uniform?
I have a snappy. We're the red suits on the mountain. I got those out to all my buddies at Vail Resorts. They got a pretty good chuckle out of it. It's all good. I'm entering into training for season two in about a month.
Ooh, I hope you earn your epaulettes or whatever, whatever you get. Graduate up the system.
Yeah, moving up.
So now let's pull back the veil of time. The first of what would be two of the most consequential ski design introductions of our lifetime. Elan's introduction of its monoblock design in around 1989. That was the same year that Salomon, with considerably more financial push behind it, would launch its first ski and its monocoque design that was eerily similar to MBX or monoblock. And we'll ask Mike about how funny it was that they were eerily similar. And also I want to know, how did monoblock construction, which was such a radical departure from traditional ski making, how did it affect your sales, your market image? How did it affect the brand?
You know, to go back in that point in time and go back to the late 80s and the early 90s, and I was in a transition period where I was becoming the senior leader at Elan. My predecessor and my mentor, Tim Jamieson, was in the process of transitioning out. And we had a bit of a run at Elan with the development of side cuts. And those major advances were entirely introduced in Elan's racing program. with fairly substantial results. And those skis that were typical of that generation of side cuts, especially was the Comprex series, both a GS and a slalom ski, but mostly in the GS skis. And they developed this real obsession with looking at side cuts, and they had some amazing results. There was one I think it was 89, where they went to the Summer World Cup in New Zealand and captured 8 out of the top 10 places on their new design. So they were getting a lot of attention.
Not market fanfare to the consumer, though. Is this reaching the mass market, this change in side cut?
Well, the Comprex series was a relatively important race group for Elan. They were able to, you know, generate more interest. It was still late in the Stenmark era, but they had a bunch of new racers too. And, you know, it was important to confirm that they were a player, at least. Did they become a huge market success? No, but they did get consideration. So it was an important thing for them. That set the stage for what was really to come and finally turned into their best all mountain, and they didn't even use the term then, but high performance recreational would be the correct one, which really became the MBX. And to answer your question about eerily similar to the Salomon, Elan did have some market intel about what Salomon was working on, because it wasn't a well-kept secret that Salomon was going to come with a ski. And they also had an introduction very typical of Salomon. They didn't want to introduce the product worldwide all at once. As you know, they introduced it in one market first, and then were bringing it out. So long story short, Salomon had some good intel about what that was. They started experimenting with what they called monoblock construction. They arrived in the marketplace with that design, with a side cut that was relevant. And then also, interestingly enough, a graphic that was developed by Michael Jagger, who later became a very successful graphic designer and really a marketing guru for Burton. He was instrumental in helping us craft something that was different and significant. So it was an interesting time. And it led ultimately to positioning Elan in a higher price point, getting them recognition in the high performance recreational game, where, in my opinion, Salomon frankly revolutionized that whole area when they came out with the proliferation of their monocoque skis.
Dear listeners, if I can elaborate on what Mike just said, because it is more impactful than just an add-on to the prior discussion. Salomon made the choice when they introduced their first ski and the monocoque shell design to make three different skis for three different experts. And that may sound so obvious today, but it was far from obvious up until that time. And that multiplication, that permission to say, hey, there's more than one type of expert on the hill, allowed the entire industry over time, and not that much time really, to go from a product pyramid where the bottom of the market predominated in units, and you had hundreds of thousands of skis selling below the midpoint in the market, to a completely flipped pyramid where, and this is so important because as ski sales shrank, it was more important than ever to get every dollar you could out of every ski you sold. And the only way to do that was to flip the product pyramid so that, in fact, the model-rich segment was all at the top, where the money is and the margin is. And you have a market today where you now have a minimum of 7 high-end skis in every product line, and maybe a maximum of 1 or 2 models down at entry level. So The Salomon introduction is the door opener, and it turns out to be a magic door because it saves everybody's ass. Whereas at the time, it was just a big pain in the ass, because if you didn't adapt to what Elan and Salomon were doing, as Tim Petrick said when he was running K2 at the time, I was going to be out of business if I didn't produce something that looked like a shell construction.
And the important thing about Solomon, well, there were two really important things in my mind that I was struck by. One was what we're talking about is the immersion of products that were outside the race category for expert skiers. And that was pivotal because if you go back and trace at the end of the 80s and early 90s, the best-selling the number that sticks in my brain is, I think it was in 1990, eight of the top-selling skis were race skis in the United States. And that completely shifted when Solomon really jumped in. The other thing was Solomon really did change the behavior of high-performance skis in a lot of ways. The feel on the snow and the edge grip were truly, remarkable. It was different. So it really was a big deal. And obviously people gravitated to it by the enormity of the success that occurred when Solomon skis hit the market.
That big thunderbolt was followed up a few years later by the apotheosis, go look it up, dear listeners, of the shape ski innovation, the SCX. You sent me a pair that you had previously, I think, sent to Seth, to other opinion leaders in the U.S. to sort of say, what would you do with this new ski? And it didn't just have a side cut. It had a radical side cut, one you could spot from across the room. And that ski is so important, is even though there was side cut fiddling around before it, that one was the one that caught the public's attention. That was the one that was called parabolic by everybody. Oh, you have a parabolic. The term shape skis, which I coined, didn't really catch on at first. First of all, it was deliberately generic. There was no other engine behind it. But Alain did a great job of putting the word parabolic in the public mind and associating with shape. And it is the one design trait from that era that has dominated ski design every single day since.
Yeah, it was a special time. And to give you some background on it, I'd taken over as president of Alain in 92. And in the moments before that, but right after that transition, I was introduced to what Alain was working on. They'd come out of the Comprex in the MBX era. And there was a third party individual named Yuri Franco, not to be confused with the Slovenian ski racer, Yuri Franco, who was an independent Slovenian ski designer. And he had this concept, which he brought to Elon. They showed interest and started testing it. And I had the opportunity early on to go on a glacier in Austria, over in Obertauern, and try them in a summer, I believe, of 91. And it was pretty interesting period, to really interesting experience. In that 203, and Jackson, you may have noticed it, but because the ski was so big, it took a little while for the sensation to occur, but I got coached up by Yuri and what to do, and that was to wait and let that ski hook up once I was on the edge. The one thing about it was, because of the length and the radius, you ended up going about 40 miles an hour before it started to hook up. But, you could get it, right? And I was able to get some of those early skis in the 203 to give to people that I respected and their opinions, like Seth Mejia, like Bill Irwin. I chose people that were completely in different parts of the country. So they weren't talking, they didn't even know each other. And then eventually people such as yourself, we were able to get those. And that was the beginning of getting a lot of feedback on the product and seeing what it was capable of.
I originally mistook it for a learning tool. This would be a great way to learn how to ski. But then my original perception of the whole genre was somewhat slanted negatively, because I idiotically took my test team, which not necessarily the best people to have done so, on a horrible day for it, all such a variable, nasty, heavy Sierra snow terrain and snow conditions that do not optimize or make it easy to detect even the benefits of shape skis. And of course, in those conditions with that crew and all the early prototypes, which were all very radical, very deep side cut skis, and they hated them. But that I couldn't have set them up for a worse result. Of course, didn't take long to realize that the problem in this whole scenario was me. And when I looked at it with an unjaundiced eye, I said, oh my God, this is a terrific thing. But I still thought the terrific thing would be a wonderful way to teach people how to ski.
Yeah. Well, you know, to go back a little bit on the longer version, you know, we were getting feedback that was really, the interesting thing was it was really universal and it was consistent. And the sensations that the testers and the people skiing on it were feeling were pretty dramatic. But at the same time, you know, the 203 thing was the stickler. And so the key in my mind in locking the potential came when, after we first were trying those skis with Yuri and getting them out on the market, we convinced Elon to bring a similar radius down into a 183 and then a 163 eventually. And that's when we started carrying those to various folks and having people ski on them. And that's when the light really went off. You know, I have a lot of anecdotal experiences. One in particular was I was at Sugarbush with my son, who was in a group of the race program. There are 10 to 12 year olds. And I grabbed all, I think there were like 8 of them. And I grabbed them all and put them on the 163. And in about a half of a run, they figured it out. And it was amazing to watch. And it just happened to be that I had seen Al Hobart, who was the founder of the Green Mountain School, that day and told him what I was going to do. And he came with us. And I really wasn't quite sure after who was more excited, me or Al. And he actually wrote a book about it. Not my experience, but the impact of shape skis on the racing market. Another aha moment came when two of my cohorts at work, Jeff Bruce, an Olympic skier, and Peter Kidd, Billy Kidd's brother, we were skiing together and they started doing some pretty fun things, among other things. They were doing 360-degree turns on the shorter SCXs. We made a video about it, of that and other things. And we're playing it at a trade show early on in our exposure of the SCX. And a young Salomon marketing and development employee named Jean-Luc Diard, who later became president of Salomon, came into the booth. He asked if he could see the ski in the video. We showed it to him and he left the room shaking his head. And at that point, I knew we had it. We had something. You know, there was those kinds of things that I really, really needed to get the confirmation of the product. To your point, we also knew that pretty obvious that this could be a pretty profound learning tool. We were getting that encouragement from Seth, from Bill, and it was, you know, something that we believe that would benefit learning skiers a lot. At that point, we were getting, you know, reviews from major publications. We had as diverse as reviews from New York Times to Newsweek to Popular Mechanics. But when we went to the resorts and the areas, those resorts and areas, for the most part, weren't thinking as much as they do now about guest experiences and servicing their guest with the best experiences. What we really needed was some kind of promoter or champion that could help us elevate this idea in the minds of resorts and frankly, the teaching community. And we were really fortunate that I had developed a relationship with Les Otten at Sunday River, the American Ski Company. And we went skiing together on it. Les wasn't, frankly, a very good skier, which was even better. He had an epiphany. He had a come-to-Jesus moment when we skied on those. And he was already, by the time we got back to the base, he had already concocted the idea of developing learning centers that would include the SCX program in it. So that really elevated the conversation about that.
That was certainly a great conversion, sort of like the Christian conversion of Emperor Constantine, because it reverberated throughout the market. Sent Bill Irwin out to work the rental market in a way, by the way, that I don't think any brand had ever done before. And he was good at preaching to the choir, and he got him on. I mean, didn't it change the Elan's market penetration dramatically?
Yeah, it did. It was substantial. Then at that point, then we were trying to cover the demand, but it was super good. But I'd like to go back to what you were talking about with Bill, because he was something. He went out and he had the ability to talk to the community, and he had the pedigree. He was an assistant ski school director, and he just would get these people involved, and they started to see the benefit. We did a lot of collaboration with the NASJA, you know, the North American Ski Journalists Association, and we got a lot of exposure with them. But these were all just really important moments. But it's a fine line because, you know, as you know, it's really difficult to say on one hand, you've got the perfect tool now for the best skiers on the mountain to change the way they ski, or at least to improve their sensations and their experience. And at the same time that you've got a learning ski, you know, so that's not an easy conversation. You know, it took, frankly, other validation from other companies had to come in on it, and it helped push the whole thing. Not the least of which was Bodie Miller's experience with the K2-4.
Not the least of which, but not the first of which. You had Head adopting in their cyber series the devout belief in shape. Now, it didn't look exactly like an SCX, but the important thing was what was already perceived as a big brand was putting their weight behind it. As Herr Schrempf said at one meeting I was attending in his incredibly inspirational way, cyber is carving, carving is cyber. He was a real rabble-rouser, that Schrempf. Point being, you did get validation from major brands. And interestingly, you talk about Diard being in the booth to watch the 360s and the video. Salomon was the last to get on the bus. Salomon protested that shape was bullshit. And meanwhile, the shape tank, for once in Salomon's life, completely ran over Salomon. They sheepishly introduced a pretty terrible sheepski called the Exendo, but they learned and chastened. They came back at another high points in your life was the introduction of probably the most successful Salomon ski of all time, the X-Scream. Yeah. Tell me about that transition that went on in Salomon.
Yeah, well, that was super interesting because literally I started at Salomon July 1st, 1996. And Exendo had been introduced at the Vegas shows and the trade shows in that spring. So it was in the market, though I had nothing. I had, you know, I was just coming into the company and looking at it. And I can just give you a few observations about it. One was that not only did Salomon avoid shape skis, they made an active campaign to discourage people from thinking thinking about merchandising shape skis. They had seminars, I was told, at Las Vegas with their key people from France involved, who were conducting seminars on the fact why you shouldn't be investing in shape skis as a retailer. So it was not just that they missed it, they were actively trying to discourage the trend. Obviously did not, and they finally had to do it. I saw a survey that they conducted post the development of the Exendo, where they went in and they talked to the people who worked on the project to get their feedback on it. And remember that Exendo, and I think you know this, is that it was developed, it was the Midnight Ski Company. I mean, it was not Salomon in taking that cerebral approach, testing it over and over again, and bringing it to market. It was a knee-jerk Midnight Ski Company reaction. And because it was so different, they surveyed the people involved And they asked them basically, how'd you like it? And they all said, we hated it, you know, and you know, you could tell the product wasn't good. And I'm sure they were not super happy with the fact they did it. That was the impression I had when I came in. But it was the big opportunity then to hit reset. And that ultimately became the X-Cream series project.
And what type of penetration did that single model get?
Over its lifetime, before it converted to pilot, but when it was truly a X-Cream flat ski, it penetrated. It had, my calculation was, it was $50 million at retail in its life. Just that model. I don't know if there's ever been a more successful ski in the marketplace than the X-Cream series. If there was, you know, it could have been a 4S or something, but I'm not clear that that was even possible. The other thing that was remarkable about it, we never discounted one pair. It was really something.
It applied Salomon's best marketing attributes to the concept of the day that they had fought so hard against. And when they did that, the formula worked again. This was a formula, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, that during the 80s, the prelude decade to this, launched a boot to no particular fanfare that in 4 years would pass Nordica in dollars. They launched a cross-country system that set the entire cross-country market completely on its head. And then they came out with monocoque design and skis, and that was a roll. And it wasn't until this X-Cream came back that they got back on that roll and applied those same sort of world-beating principles to that particular product and hit it out of the park.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, you were close to it because that's what we were doing on Mount Hood when we did that boot pack. We had cream of the crop, influencers, and professional skiers involved in what I thought was, if I could look back and say one gathering, it was amazing to see this group come together in this product experience, which was just remarkable and really compelling. Everyone had the same experience and the same, you know, endorsement of the product. But your point is extremely important. It was back on track where Salomon was not looking, you know, not reacting. They were doing what they do best. And what they do best is they look at consumers. They look at what consumer benefits they can provide. In some cases, even obstacles they're solving for consumers. But at the end of the day, they're looking at the consumer and saying, what is it that we can do in this genre in order to deliver a better experience? And that whole thing was the next iteration of taking a slightly, you know, wider ski than their platform, putting a side cut that was appropriate, but the construction was incredible. The edge feel and the skiing characteristics were, frankly, no one had felt that before. And it was really profound.
At the end of the day, the real charge behind X-Cream was consumer led.
Yeah.
Sure, Salomon promoted the shit out of it. They knew exactly what they were doing.
But and they made it look different. I mean, I don't know if you remember the original images were very different than anyone was showing about skiing. And the first ad that ran showed a picture of Chris Davenport. He was in, you know, just all the codes were different. He was in North Face clothing. He had his skis in a pack. He was climbing. Just that image that this is for a different experience, for a broader experience. And it really opened the door to saying, this isn't just your normal on-piste experience. This started the push to get people thinking about, I don't want to say backcountry, but it was certainly a different code of what people were going to do on the mountain.
You mentioned something a moment ago that struck me, and it was about the integrated system, the pilot, that was also coming down the pike. To me, the pilot was a stumble. And at the time, it was perceived as, oh my gosh, someone's finally done something with integration, because the word integration had been used before without anything that really was integrated. And then along comes this ski and binding system from Salomon, much, much fanfare. And at the end of the day, I think it ended up doing more harm to Solomon's binding business than it helped their ski business.
Mm.
Your comments?
I guess I would set the stage and tell you what was going on in the marketplace. First of all, there was going to be a push to systems. It was coming. The clear entree was that Atomic had acquired Device, and they were moving to that level because they wanted to be in the binding business. Rosignol owned Look and Gateway by default as well. And Solomon was, they were going, well, do we want to be first or do we want to be third? And you're right. It was a gamble, because at that point we were selling in the US market only, including rental, about 400,000 pair of a la carte bindings. And the minute that we started, systems came into the market, we knew that there was going to be a big decline in a la carte business, if nothing else, because we weren't capturing some big brands, potentially, you know, we had 40% of the binding market. We weren't going to capture some big brands. So it was a gamble. I, for one, was encouraging them to be first, not be third. But the caveat was the pilot had to perform as well as its predecessor flat skis. And that became the problem. In my opinion, Pilot was never able to fill the shoes of the Extreme series with an a la carte binding. And while the sell-in of the product was spectacular for 2 years, eventually the sellout didn't keep up with the sell-in. So I think your analysis is correct. It did have an impact.
Were you at Solomon when Adidas bought it?
I was.
Well, tell me what that did internally and then what the repercussions were, say, 2 or 3 years later.
It was interesting. As I read the outline for today, it brought me back to Annecy, France, where Solomon's located. I was in the building when we all congregated in MT2, which you know well, the auditorium at Solomon with all the French employees. And the Solomon family announced that they had sold the company. And it was profound. I mean, people were very emotional, as you can imagine. It was a big deal. Solomon family was a big deal in Annecy. The Solomon company was a proud, you know, everyone was proud of that, of the company. And it had an effect on people. When we came back, they came back and we told, you know, the employees, we met with the Adidas people in Massachusetts and got to know them, and then eventually became clear we'd be moving to Portland, Oregon to integrate with the Adidas headquarters there. It was a big transition for the company. I think that, you know, if I look at the motivations and if you reflect back in that period of time, Nike had started to venture into a lot of different sport categories, and that included golf. They were exploring winter sports, and Adidas used the opportunity. You know, they tended to be followers of Nike at that point. And so this acquisition, which had been led by some people that weren't necessarily in the operating leadership of Adidas, but were in the investment side, thought this was a way for Adidas to differentiate and to progress in new sports. And they made the decision to do it. They paid a lot of money for it. As you know, they paid $2 to $3 billion equivalent, which in that day was a lot of money when they did it. So it was a big move. But at the same time, they got the world's best winter sports equipment company. They got TaylorMade, which is a really important component of why they did it, because they wanted to get into golf. And probably the least appreciated part of the acquisition was Arc'teryx. And they really never understood what they got there, but that proved to be a benefit for Amer down the road.
I want to talk in a minute about the celebrity marriage that didn't last, because, as you know, Adidas ended up breaking up, if you will.
Well, the reality was that the purchase of Salomon was very contentious at Adidas. Many senior managers did not support the purchase, and those same people that did not support it ended up running the company. And they made it really clear that they had no interest in Salomon, and that went for the relationship of the senior management in Europe, their relationship with the group in Germany. It was clear in our North American organization in Portland, Oregon. Though, as I said, they did want TaylorMade, and you could argue that was a large piece of the motivation for them to acquire Salomon. But in any case, yeah, when they had the opportunity to sell the company, they took advantage of it. And again, I think what they didn't understand, because they really never spent, I don't think, the time to get to know us very well, that the real sleeping beauty that was beside Salomon was Arc'teryx, and they let that go to Amer.
So Amer was the buyer. By the way, it was a dark horse at the time. I was in the skiing trade journalism racket at the time. And I remember writing about Salomon being in play. And I lofted in my very last sentence, you know, there's this Finnish outfit that might actually end up being a part player in this thing. And people are going, Finnish? And they're what the hell? And if you looked up who's who at Amer, they were selling things like cigarettes and Toyotas. Finland, and you're just going, excuse me?
The Amer company is interesting. If you go back and look at the history, they had heavy investments in tobacco and into in some industrial areas of equipment and tooling, et cetera. Largely, their customer base was the iron bloc nations in Russia, so that they were not really selling in Western Europe. But someone had the foresight to maybe look at that at some point and said, this is probably not a good idea to be selling tobacco. And so they exited that and morphed into a sporting goods company by about the mid-90s, right around the time they bought out of bankruptcy Atomic. It's a pretty impressive story. They got out of the tobacco business without one lawsuit. That was probably my most impressive part of it. And so they were on a significant move to become a sporting goods company, which included Wilson was their first real successful purchase, and then on through a number of others through Atomic. The leadership at Amer in Finland included a CEO, Roger Tellermo, who was a former Salomon employee.
I must interrupt you there for one second. I knew Roger Tellermo.
I'm sure you did.
I was at the binding division frequently then, part of my role, and there was this guy over in the corner, and he was kind of wearing the equivalent of a corporate dunce cap. In other words, he was there because he had been mismanaging the Finnish subsidiary and was going to be brought in to sort of learn how to think more like we want you to think as a Salomon national subsidiary. He wasn't a serious, studious character. He was a open-minded, fresh-faced guy who was being taught the Salomon way. And I couldn't have been more amazed when I think at the Salomon E intro, there was Roger Tellermo, head of the whole operation.
So Roger left Salomon and became the president of Atomic under Amer. His path then led back to Finland. He is Finnish, and he became the president and the CEO of Amer. In the meantime, hired a guy named Michael Schneis, who was also a Salomon employee. He was the head of the German subsidiary, become president of Atomic. And so what I'm getting in a long about way, that's how they were inclined to think very, very favorably about Salomon and that opportunity to purchase Salomon from Adidas was really, it would only happen because they were they were driving the ship. And that really turned out to be a great thing for them.
Any challenges over time keeping the two brands separate? You have two very big, very powerful brands now under the same roof.
Give you a little bit of context. In 2007, after the purchase of Salomon by Ameren, we were transitioning out of the Portland facility. I was asked to leave the Salomon brand and become the general manager for Atomic. And essentially, there was doing a restart for the Atomic brand, which had been on a really good roll, but in the last few years had been spinning. It's a brand steeped in race, in a market that was transitioning in North America, but they had shown huge potential still, but strayed a lot in their shape ski approach, as well as their boot business. And they needed to get a lot of things right, and they needed a reboot in North America. So I was asked to do that. And since they were asking, I thought it was a good idea to accept. And I was completely immersed in the Atomic world for 5 years and was really fortunate to have that opportunity because it was a great experience for me. It wasn't without its bumps, but I had the opportunity to introduce the more progressive aspects of North American skiing inside the brand and bring them to a different awareness of what they could be in the North American market. And I was real fortunate because I had not only support of Atomic, but especially the support of the new younger GM, a guy named Wolfgang Meyerhofer, who gave me the rope. Hopefully I wasn't going to hang myself, but gave me the rope in order that I could try to bring in a new direction to the brand. And in that regard, I was really fortunate to be able to hire a young man named Jordan Judd, who connected us really with the progressive ski world in the U.S., principally through his connections at Teton Gravity, and most importantly with Chris Benchetler. And that was kind of the start of the whole thing.
So switching gears on you, Mike, for just a few minutes, I want to talk about something which is extremely important in the context of today's market. We were talking about a period from roughly the 90s into the middle of the next decade. And that was a period in which Salomon was quietly, and I mean, Mike, because it was mostly off everyone's radar, because they were losing money in buckets, to build something which everyone since has absolutely wanted to do for their brand, even if it kills them, which is to have a brand extension as successful as what Salomon would do in footwear. This was concomitant with another phenomenon, which was Salomon's ability and interest in communicating direct to the consumer, which would allow them to facilitate direct-to-consumer business in ways that other brands wouldn't catch on to for years. Everyone's caught on to this now. Every brand is selling directly against their own competition, trying to build something like what Salomon has done. And they are bathing in red ink, trying to match this success. You were around when this was happening. Tell me about this particular period and its impact on the market today.
Yeah, well, you know, it goes back a bit to the evolution of leadership at Salomon and its involvement and as part of the portfolio of Ameren. There was a significant time in 2010 when the board of directors of Ameren basically cleaned house of management. And that was the departure of Roger and others. And they hired a really smart individual in Europe who came from Procter & Gamble. And the idea was, as you can imagine, the appeal was that Heike Takla, is the individual's name, had huge experience at Procter & Gamble of running portfolios. And the portfolio of sporting goods that and outdoor brands that, you know, Ameren was now holding was significant. Heike had several priorities. He was very clear, and he had really good business training and the ability to pass on the strategy to the entire organization. And there were several pillars that he communicated. One was to grow faster in soft goods being apparel and footwear. Two was to grow faster in the U.S., North America, and China. And third was to grow the online channel. I should say the direct-to-consumer channel, because it was a two-pronged approach, which was both own stores, direct-to-consumer, as well as e-com. We were then called on to, as brand leaders and category leaders, to implement those. And obviously, we were hard goods, so we weren't really able to contribute too much to the soft goods. But obviously, Salomon could directly, and they fortified their footwear and their apparel business, but primarily footwear. We established relationships in China, but the real initiative was around direct-to-consumer. Salomon was launching really quickly. They were following the guise of Arc'teryx, which was also launching really quickly. We were asked to look at what we could do on the hard goods side. And in 2011 and 12, we developed a business plan for hard goods that was called Ski Link. We trademarked it. We had a logo. We came up with an entire Q&A. We had a whole plan built of how we were going as hard goods into e-com. And as you know, it was really contentious at that point. There was a lot of retribution that could occur from the marketplace on companies that were going to make that move. We were fortunate because we not only had a really good plan that was involving the retail base in a very, in not only the approach, but also in the transaction on a revenue share basis, but we talked to the retail community as much as they didn't like it. We were in and talking to them for almost a year about how we wanted to do it. And we got them to engage. And we got them to start to buy in to the program. Unfortunately, the way we built it was going to be really expensive to implement from a software side and management side. And frankly, the impetus was to, as the priority was to grow faster in soft goods, it got put on the shelf. And it was mothballed for a number of years. But meantime, Salomon in footwear was starting to really develop a significant business, not just in online, but the point being that they nailed the trail running category, and they were just growing by leaps and bounds and becoming a real player. That was really the concentration for a number of years, really until 2021, when Salomon rebooted a plan to go into direct sales e-com. It was now evolved to be called Sight to Snow, and was again very collaborative, showed a path of how retailers could be involved in the transaction. They could be involved at a level of 100%, receiving 100% of the revenue, or in a plan that involved revenue sharing with the company, utilized some really good platforms like Locally to integrate the inventory of the retailer into visibility to the consumer, had an order online, ship to store. It is a great program, and it got implemented, and they're the first ones who did it successfully.
So I steered you off what we'd been talking about before, but I'm glad I did, because I think what Salomon did revolutionized its brand and is in the process of forcing transformation by a lot of other brands as well. I think they forced everyone else's hand to say, we've got to up our game to compete with what they're doing. Now, while you're still at Amer, it's acquired for, I think, over $5 billion. Correct. By a Chinese-led consortium. But production continued to come from Austria, right?
Yeah. The acquisition of Amer was made by four entities. Principal one was Anta Sports in China, but also it consisted of a technology company called Tencent, a private equity company led by some former Goldman Sachs Chinese employees based in Shanghai. And then probably the most interesting party that participated was the founder of Lululemon, Chip Wilson, who Canadian. who came in on 25% of the company as well.
There's been other repercussions from this change in ownership. Wasn't there a gorgeous R&D center we were going to go see when we were taking our trip that got scuttled by the pandemic?
The R&D center is alive and well. That's in the current facility, and it is thriving. What did disappear was in the consolidation over time that was initiated far before the Chinese were involved. Was the rationalization of production facilities so that all the ski production moved to Austria. They have a satellite facility in Bulgaria. All the boot production went to the Salomon facility in Romania. Atomic and Salomon went there. And that eventually took over the binding assembly process as well. So the R&D represented at Salomon a significant investment and is alive and well. But all the production was consolidated and rationalized to go to the best place that existed between Atomic and Salomon.
Gotcha. So the consortium that owns Amer is going back to the capital markets to raise from $1 to $3 billion. And I presume current ownership would stay in place. The intention isn't here to sell to one investor, but to simply make an offering to the mass investment market. Is that the right way to say it?
Yeah, it's to go public with a certain share of the company. This had been rumored for over a year, and I think the rumors got strong enough that they finally decided to reveal their intentions. And that indeed is their intention, is to raise between $1 and $3 billion. You have to remember that when you have private equity involved, this is not a long-term play. That what they wanted to do was to shape the company in a place where they could start to be attractive in the capital markets and get, you know, frankly, start to recoup some of the money that they invested in the purchase. They have done some of that already through the sale of Precor, a minor sale of Mavic and Suunto. I would say that it's likely that if they could find a buyer, they'd also divest of Envy. But right now, the principal thing is they've got the company in a place where they feel they can go to the market and raise some money without losing control of the company. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I think they'd like to get closer to $3 billion than $1 billion, but time will tell how that goes. The main thing to realize is when they took over the company 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago, they restated their objectives, and they were a little more specific about brand strength. And while they agreed with the former management about the importance of the geography, North America and China, about the importance of direct-to-consumer, they were really more specific about brands. And their stated objective was to build Salomon, Arc'teryx, and Wilson each to $1 billion. And they have crossed that threshold basically with all three brands. So it's a big deal. They grew it a lot.
How much do you think suppliers are actually selling directly today? I'm talking about ski brands, and specifically everyone's selling directly online. Everyone's saying to the consumer, come on in, get full warranty from the factory. You know, don't need to go see those pesky dealers anymore. How much is that affecting their business with the retailer community, and how successful are brands being globally at trying to sell direct?
It's a small part of their business. And I'm talking about the, let's say the top, you know, the 10 or 12 brands that we think of when we think of Alpine skiing. You know, most have a omni-channel approach, but I would say it's less than 15%. That's maybe even generous, 15. If you take out pro and store employee or promotional sales, it's going to be smaller. But on the other hand, the reality is that there's a whole market that is outside of this community of brands that are selling online. And I had the opportunity to look at all the ski brands that exist across the globe and catalog them. And right now, it'll probably have been diminished a bit through COVID, but there are approximately 125 ski brands globally, and 60% of those were only available, well, it's higher than that, 70% of those were only available online. So there's a community of small ski producers who are only involved online, and it's a fairly robust and substantial number. If you look at the total market, it's probably at least 100,000 pair and probably closer to 200,000 pair, which is a number in the ski world. So yes, it's not been a particularly robust area for the traditional ski companies to participate in, though when they do participate, generally it's very profitable. There is a whole group that don't participate in brick and mortar that are selling direct to consumer, and they're getting more and more placement.
I see that market growing as well. Salomon built its business on convenience features, and I'm asking you at this point in time to get your crystal ball out and polish it up a little bit. As we look forward into the future, the boot division is now making a big commitment to BOA, which is basically a boot design being part of your boot design being turned over to your subcontractor, which I can't think of the Salomon of yore ever having done. But the point is, BOA's convenience feature, we're seeing a lot of other convenience features that are still motivating the market to buy. From a design standpoint, are we going to see more design emphasis on convenience features, particularly those that facilitate or online sales or direct sales? I mean, BOA, after all, is basically saying, hey, don't worry about the size precisely, because you just set the dial and off you go. Is that where we're heading as a collective?
I think there's an element of that. I would suggest that Salomon, when they introduced the original rear entry boots, they were really talking about that as well. Now, they had to make a performance claim, but there was a huge emphasis on convenience. And so I don't think it's unheard of for them. However, the BOA thing, you're right, is a little different. I immediately asked for a pair because I wanted to ski in them. I was, knew that it was coming. And when you're working on the mountain, it's a really nice boot to have. I thought Salomon's approach and how they are doing BOA is the one that's really the most potential. You may recall there are three brands that introduced BOA: Atomic, K2, and Salomon. Atomic and K2 came at it from the backcountry side, touring boots, which I think is interesting. It has a good thing. Salomon came right at it from the on-piste recreational market. And in my opinion, that's the big prize.
I don't want to put the position of defending K2, but in fact, they added a BOA option. You could get the same boot with buckles, or you could get it with BOA for their entire Mindbender and Recon collection.
I think going after the big prize, which is, the meat of the market, is the right one, that Salomon did that. The issue I always think about when you're talking about convenience or performance or how you blend those is that if you... oftentimes in the ski business, innovation has come at the top end, which you could argue was more applicable to the lower price points and the lower price point skier, less experienced skier, in the sense that they would benefit more from it. BOA is a really expensive product to add to anything, so it's hard to decline. It's not easy to decline the price points because of the cost. But ultimately, I think the success will be when Salomon is able to put that, not in cheap boots by any means, but in maybe coming down a little bit price points, maybe down around $499 with the product. But I skied in it. I really, really liked it. I'm ready to go for next year on it too.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Mike Adams is endorsing BOA. I'll be accepting a small check, a much smaller check, of course, later on. I'd like to end on one note that is somewhat of an ambivalent note. You were the chairman of the board of SIA for a while. SIA, I think right now, in my opinion, I'm not putting these words in your mouth, is an organization adrift. What advice would you give the current leadership if you were still on the board?
It's a little bit of context, and I'll go back a little bit, if you don't mind, to the point in time where we, as a board member and the board in general, we were facing some really important decisions. The context was we owned a trade show, which was the reason for being, really, for SIA, that was declining in revenue to a point where we were looking at what could be out into the future, and it frankly did not look that interesting. At the same time, we had a change of leadership as David Ingemy left and Nick Sargent came in. Nick was well connected with certain entities in the trade show business and others that led to conversations about what would we be or could we, in fact, sell the trade show. And that became, you know, the major focus for a period of time. And Nick, in my opinion, was able to secure a very, very good offer. And as board members, we had to consider what the best option was. And as a board, we accepted the idea that we would sell the trade show. It was about $16 million the trade organization realized. When we did that, it was certainly not unappreciated amongst the board that what do we do now became the question, right? And what are we if we have now taken away our chief reason for being running a trade show in a trade organization, and what do we do? And that leads me to discuss your question. They're in a difficult situation because they need that reference point for what are we providing as value to members of the organization. Now, I will say that if you look at the world now and looking back, we were right in selling the trade show. As you know, trade shows have been impacted hugely by the pandemic, and that experience has driven down attendance and the relevance of trade shows immeasurably. So I think we were really fortunate that we were able to do that and be free of that. If you look at an organization like OIA Outdoor Industries, they're facing huge problems because they are tied to the trade show revenue that Emerald produces for outdoor retailer. An outdoor retailer is frankly just a shadow of itself, of what it used to be. So I'm not going to do anything but compliment the group on having made that decision. But the biggest difficulty is, what do we do now? So the group has looked at a few things, and they've tried through acquisition of Binding Mechanics Workshop. They bought a consumer show from Bernie Weitzel, various things on that end to try to provide revenue. They've also tried to provide through its pillars of participation, education, market research, and also climate. They've tried to attract relevance for the members. But it's not easy. And I'm the first one to admit that it hasn't been easy for them. Trying to replace about $4 million in revenue is a tough deal. And so that's the predicament. My observation, though I haven't been around it for a bit, is that they still don't have, they just don't have the formula yet. Though they have tried to realign their dues. They've tried to recruit members. They're talking a lot to the membership. But it's not an easy situation.
Appreciate your candor, Mike. It's been a pleasure having you as my guest on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Dear listeners, I hope you found this episode as edifying as I have. Thanks for listening.